Okay, welcome back to the 2S Horror Quarters podcast, another Ghosts of LA edition. I want to thank you for joining me again, and today we are going to cover what I consider to be the Ghost of LA. Now, Los Angeles, I know, has a history of hundreds of thousands and millions of tragic stories, but in the true crime community, in the true crime world, especially in Los Angeles, to me, this is the Ghost of LA, and we are talking about Elizabeth Short, also known as the Black Dahlia, who on January 15th, 1947, was found cut in half in a vacant lot on South Norton Avenue. I know there are a lot of theories, a lot of people have written books, done interviews, you know, claiming it was a family member that did it, or their father, or their great-grandfather, or their brother. I mean, sky's the limit when it comes to the theories. And I'm not discounting any of those theories, but this particular episode, I'll cover a few of those theories that I kind of lean towards being plausible. And we'll cover a few of those. It was a cold, clear Wednesday, kind of a brisk morning in the Leimert Park section of Los Angeles. And one of the residents, a Betty Bursinger, was heading southbound on a walk, pushing a stroller with her three-year-old daughter Anne in it. And they were headed to a shoe repair shop to get a few things for Betty's husband. It was about 10 a.m. And again, southbound on the west side of the street there, walking along the sidewalk. Now, there were homes to the north of this vacant lot, and there were homes to the south of this vacant lot. And because of the war, a lot of the construction, not only in this area, but other areas across the country, probably stopped. So this particular block would be the 3800 block of South Norton Avenue. And during the walk, Betty mentioned that there was some broken glass on the concrete, so she maneuvers around it. And as she's maneuvering around the glass, she kind of glances and sees something off to her right in the grass and in the weeds there, because these vacant lots had grass and kind of out overgrown weeds, a lot of dirt, a lot of rubbish that people have thrown in there. And what she saw appeared to her to be a mannequin cut in two, a mannequin that is very pale, very white. And she knew something wasn't right. And looking around, it was the time of day that kids were outside riding bikes, running around, playing. And Betty thought, well, this could scare some of the kids. And something didn't feel right about it. So she continues on her walk, pushing the stroller south, crosses the street there, and knocks on the first door across the street and gets no answer. Moves on to the second house and gets an answer, and then that's when the call was made to LAPD. The call came in at approximately 10:55 a.m. Betty said, and I quote, "My goodness, it was so white. It didn't look like anything more than perhaps an artificial model. It was so white and separated in the middle. I noticed the dark hair and this white, white form." Here we are at 3705 South Norton Avenue. This is Betty Bursinger's home. So you can kind of see in relation to where Elizabeth was found. Here is an aerial shot of the distance between Betty's house and where Elizabeth was found, which was roughly 1,110 feet south of Betty's house. Here is a shot of the direction Betty Bursinger was walking. And this is heading southbound again on the west side of the street. Now, on the audio interview that Betty Bursinger gave, there was a little bit of confusion as to which house she knocked on and which house that someone answered the door. Now, I know it has been documented that she knocked on the first door across the street there. No one answered. And then the second house, when she knocked, someone did answer. And then from there, the phone call was made to police. But like I said, in Betty's interview, she had somewhat of a little bit of confusion as to which house it was, because it had been so long since that day to when the interview was conducted. Now, here are those first two houses on the corner. I know 75 years ago, things were probably a lot different. But to the best of my knowledge, these were the homes that she was referring to. Now, for the sake of Elizabeth and for the guidelines of the YouTube channel, I will not be showing these photos in their graphic detail. There are plenty of opportunities online if anyone wants to look at these photos. Just look it up and you'll see them in their entirety. I do warn you though, if you have not seen them, they are quite disturbing. So again, I will not be showing those photos in their graphic detail on this particular episode. So the call was placed at 10:55 a.m. and at approximately 11:07 a.m., the first two responding officers arrived. One Frank Perkins and one Will Fitzgerald. And as the morning progressed, as more police and authorities arrived, so did the word of mouth in the streets, so did the press. And at the time, there were four competing newspapers to get photos, to get interviews, to try to get the scoop. So the place itself became somewhat of a circus. Here are the lead detectives on the case. Harry Hansen on the left, Finus Brown on the right. And then here are some other photos. Like I said, I'm not going to show the mutilated pictures. I'm going to blur them out, but I just want you to see the positioning of Elizabeth at this point. And here is the street now, present time. It's just a regular neighborhood on Norton Avenue. And you can see here on the right about the corner here where the grass is where she lay, 54 feet north of this hydrant. And about 3 feet off to the left there is where she was, which puts her here, right about the corner of this grass. Once all photos were taken, all documentations were noted, all evidence collected, photographed, Elizabeth's body was loaded into an aluminum coffin and into the coroner's vehicle, which at the time, coincidentally, was called Black Maria. Black Maria then headed downtown to the Hall of Justice, where the morgue was located. There, Elizabeth was taken out of the vehicle and weighed on some ground-level scales. It wasn't until the following day, January 16th, that the autopsy was performed by Dr. Frederick Neubauer. And Dr. Neubauer has seen probably thousands of bodies and conducted probably thousands of autopsies at the time, but never had seen anything like this, nor had anyone else around. This was something new, something so grotesque that it was something that you couldn't even make up. Dr. Neubauer was the chief autopsy surgeon for LA County at the time. Elizabeth's body was laid across the autopsy table and her head was propped up by a wooden block. The final report, though gruesome, was quite informative in the context of the investigation. Female, obviously, between 15 to 20 years of age, height 5'5", and weighing approximately 115 pounds. Multiple lacerations to the facial area inflicted most likely by a sharp instrument, such as a knife or a blade of some sort. From each corner of the mouth outward, there were lacerations of over 3 inches long, forming that Joker-like smile. There were depressed ridges and indentations on Elizabeth's wrists, and this suggested that she was strung up somewhere while being tortured. Dr. Neubauer's findings stated that the lacerations to the face and blows to Elizabeth's skull were inflicted while she was still alive. The face lividity, postmortem lividity, suggested that at some point after death, Elizabeth was face down. It's to be noted, too, that Elizabeth's body was drained of blood. Now, depending on what you read and who you may talk to about the case, they do mention that potentially there were one or two droplets there of blood, diluted drops. One was over a heel print and one in an empty cement bag. All other lacerations were said to have been inflicted after death. There were these crisscross type patterns etched on Elizabeth's body in a few places, and the pubic region was one of those places. It was like a tic-tac-toe type of drawing. Dr. Neubauer, based on his report, suggested death had occurred within 24 hours or less. Also on Elizabeth's body, in some of the crevices, there were some cocoa fibers found, like from a cocoa fiber brush. So apparently she had been cleaned off, brushed off. Now, I have researched this and read that there were three things that police kept close to the vest that they didn't want the public to know, and this kind of weeds out all the people claiming to have done this, where one, Elizabeth had a rose tattoo on her left thigh that was cut out and placed into the vaginal cavity. Two, the pubic hair, some of her pubic hair, was shoved into her anal cavity. And again, this stuff is disturbing. Police had to keep that quiet to see if they found anyone that would know those two things. There were various scratches that appeared on Elizabeth's left breast, while a square piece of tissue was removed from Elizabeth's right breast. It was also noted that she had old scar tissue, probably from a previous operation. Now, police also noted that there was dew on Elizabeth's back, because dew on that particular morning would have been there between 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. The timetable would have been anywhere between 2 and 6 as to when she was placed there. Now, after this, police needed to identify who she was, and at the time, there were no fax machines. So there was a machine owned by one of the papers that they called a sound photo machine. And the process is they take pictures of each fingerprint on Elizabeth and send that through the sound photo machine to the FBI, where the FBI at the time had to look through it pretty much manually. And not every photo made it okay. I mean, there were, I think, 6 to 7 of the photos of her fingerprints were blurred, so I think there were only 2 usable ones. At any rate, they were able to find 2 matches for Elizabeth Short, and it didn't take that long at all, within a couple of hours. There were 2 hits for Elizabeth Short's fingerprints. One of them came from the U.S. Army's Camp Cook in Lompoc, California. Elizabeth once had a job there. And the second hit came from Santa Barbara. Elizabeth was arrested for underage drinking, though they say she wasn't drinking, that she was just in this group of people, but she was underage nonetheless at the El Paseo restaurant in Santa Barbara, and she was booked right across the street from that restaurant at police headquarters. Elizabeth and the arresting officer, Mary Unkefer, walked across the street, and Elizabeth was booked and processed there. This is where the famous mugshot, where Elizabeth's kind of staring right through you with those gray eyes, the black and white photo, this is where that was taken in Santa Barbara. And Mary actually ended up taking Elizabeth in for a few days to help her out and then sending her back to Medford. The date was September 23rd, 1943, that Elizabeth was arrested here at this restaurant called El Paseo in Santa Barbara. And the charge was underage drinking. Now, it's been said and noted that she wasn't actually drinking, but she was in the company of a group that was drinking. So she was arrested. The arresting officer, as mentioned before, was a Mary Unkefer, who walked her across the street to here, City Hall. Now, 75 years ago, I know a lot of this looked different. So based on what I'm seeing here, either Elizabeth walked across this crosswalk here or the one over here. I'm going to guess that she was booked back here, away from the street. This other entrance here looks like just a main entrance at the time. But either way, this is City Hall, and this is where that famous mugshot was taken. The famous black and white mugshot of Elizabeth, where she's got those gray eyes just staring right through you. So what we find out about Elizabeth Short is that she was born on July 29th, 1924 in Hyde Park, Massachusetts. She was the middle child of 5 girls to Cleo and Phoebe Short. In 1926, the family upped and moved to Medford. And not too long after that, their father, Cleo, left the family. They found his car parked near a bridge in town, so it was assumed that he jumped and killed himself. Well, that wasn't the case. You know, they ran into him later on. He pretty much faked his suicide. It's been reported that Phoebe walked right into him in town. Him bumping back into the family led to Elizabeth and her father, rekindling their relationship, and she ended up moving first to Vallejo with her father. That didn't work out too well, and apparently she only lasted about 3 weeks with her dad before he ended up kicking her out. After she left her dad's spot in Vallejo, she moved in with some friends and got the job at Camp Cook. So while she was working at Camp Cook, she ended up meeting a sergeant, and this guy apparently put hands on her, and she broke up with him, and then she moved on to Santa Barbara, where she lived with somebody else on Montecito Street. And she had only been there a week before she got arrested at the El Paseo restaurant and booked across the street at City Hall, where the police station was. So like I mentioned before, the arresting officer, Mary Unkeford, took Elizabeth in for a few days and ended up giving her money for a bus back to Medford. Once she was in Medford for a little while, she didn't stay long. She soon left to Florida. While in Florida, she met a guy from the Air Force named Matt Gordon. They dated for a while and they were engaged. Unfortunately, Matt Gordon had to return to active duty in 1945, where he subsequently was shot down and killed in India. And of course, this left Elizabeth distraught. So Elizabeth moved on. She dated a lot, particularly men in uniform. After a short stint in Indianapolis and Chicago, Elizabeth made her way back to California, Long Beach specifically, in pursuit of Gordon Fickling. Gordon Fickling was an Air Force lieutenant and stationed in Long Beach. So this story was an extremely hot story. It was the OJ of the day. It was the Sharon Tate, LaBianca, Manson family story of the time. But before the internet, obviously, so the city was frantic. The newspapers were selling like hotcakes. But still, there wasn't a lot of information outside of, you know, slain girl, cut in half, found in vacant lot. Werewolf slain is what they called it at one point, too. So police were desperate for any kind of information as to who did it, when, why, how, so on and so forth. The story began to fizzle out. It was on January 23rd that the city editor, Jimmy Richardson, received a phone call from a stranger, essentially, a strange man on the other end. Asked Jimmy, you know, what's your name? Jimmy responds, Richardson. The man on the other end says, you've done a great job with the Dahlia case, but it appears you're running out of stuff. The man on the other end responds to Jimmy by congratulating him on his work on the Dahlia case. Then the man says, you seem to have run out of material. Jimmy's like, yeah. The guy on the other end says, perhaps I can be of assistance with that. And Jimmy says, we need it. And the mystery man responds with, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll send you some of the things she had with her when she, shall we say, disappeared. Jimmy's like, what kinds of things? To which he responds, her address book, birth certificate, and a few other things. Jimmy all the while was trying to have the phone call traced. Fast forward to 2 days later, Jimmy gets a call from the postal inspector, and they tell Jimmy that a package addressed to the Los Angeles Examiner was intercepted there by police, and they're getting ready to open it up. They open it up, and they find that there are various newspaper clippings used to form the words on the letter. And the package itself reeked heavily of gasoline. So when the package was opened down at the post office, there were some interesting things uncovered. And it turns out it was sent on the 24th, which would have been the day after the phone call to Jimmy. The envelope read, here is Dahlia's belongings, letter to follow. It contained Elizabeth's birth certificate, her social security card, a claim check card from the Greyhound station dated January 9th, which would have been for two suitcases and one hat box. There was a telegram in there from the Railway Express in regards to another trunk, which we'll get to. Business cards, multiple photographs of Elizabeth with various men in uniform, and a brown leather notebook containing names and numbers of different people. Now, depending on what you read or who you ask, it could be one page, it could be several pages, but I'm just going to go with several pages here were torn out of this address book for whatever reason. And on the cover of this particular book, the numbers 1937 and the name Mark Hansen appeared. Now remember, the package stated that there would be a letter to follow. Well, the following day, a letter came in. and it read, "Here it is. Turning in Wednesday, January 29th, 10 a.m. Had my fun at police. Black Dahlia Avenger." Authorities made a note that it appeared the letter had been written with a new ballpoint pen. Now, at the time, ballpoint pens weren't cheap. I think they went for around $6 back then, so not everybody had them, which, you know, isn't a huge clue, but it's definitely substantial. So it was here on January 24th, 1947, that one high heel and a purse were found in a dumpster at a cafe that once stood here. The cafe address at the time was 1136 Crenshaw Boulevard. I cannot find 1136 Crenshaw, but I did find 1132 and 1140, which is what's pictured here. So in this general vicinity, a man by the name of Robert Hymans found and reported the shoe and purse in a dumpster somewhere here. And by the time the police got there, the dumpster was already removed. So police had to sift through the dump to locate those items. And here is Red Manley identifying those items and linking them to Elizabeth Short. So in my research, I read a lot of books regarding this case, a lot of articles, listened to a lot of information, be it podcasts or interviews, TV specials. So I know that there's no one solid answer. I mean, there's going to be different things that I've heard versus what you've heard, and I'm not trying to sell what I'm saying as concrete. I just kind of try to sift through different scenarios, different things, and maybe you can just decide for yourself what you think happened. When reconstructing Elizabeth's timeline, authorities, researchers were kind of stumped as to why Elizabeth went down to San Diego 1 month before she died. I know she was kind of nomadic, so maybe she just decided, you know, she was at her wit's end, you know, with men, with life. She was staying at different hotels, motels, people's houses, people's rooms, rooming houses. Maybe it was time for her to, you know, out of frustration, to get out of LA. At any rate, she ends up in San Diego on December 8th, 1946, and she is found inside of the Aztec Theater by one of the employees there by the name of Dorothy French. She said Elizabeth was sleeping. Now, at the time, the Aztec Theater did attract a lot of the homeless. All we can do is speculate as to what led Elizabeth down there. Maybe she heard that the Aztec Theater can put her up for a night. Who knows? Whatever her reasons, she ended up there. Dorothy French, who was a cashier there, befriended her, talked, and invited her to live with her and her mother nearby, an Elvira French. While she stayed at the French's house for about 30 days, she kind of wore out her welcome. You know, it's been said that she slept in a lot. She kept weird hours. And it was time for her to go at one point. Here is 665 Fifth Avenue, San Diego, California, at what was once the Aztec Theater. I don't know what years these particular photos are from, probably the 70s to the 90s, something like that. But back then, it was the Aztec Theater as well. And to me, this is one of the most interesting parts of the case, because this is where she upped and left LA for whatever reason, 1 month before she was killed. Came all the way down to San Diego for reasons unknown. I had to go visit this place because, like I said, it's a pivotal point. Here it is today. It's the Urban Outfitters. And just, you know, envisioning her walking in here, probably depressed, alone, lost, you kind of get a sense of her loneliness, you know, or her unsureness in life to up and move from LA and head way down here. This interested me a lot as to why. I guess we'll never know that, but here's the building. During this time in San Diego, when she was walking right across the street from the Western Airlines at the time, a man by the name of Robert Red Manley was driving by, pulled over and attempted to pick her up. You know, she didn't take too kindly of it right away, but ended up getting in the car with him. And they took a drive, and he dropped her off later on at the French's house. Robert was a married man, but he was out there, you know. While she was staying at the French's, Robert Manley sent her a telegram saying he was going to pick her up on January 8th and that he wanted to see her. So that day came, Robert picks her up, Elizabeth leaves the French's house for the last time, and with her, in her possession, were two suitcases and one hat box. She gets in the car with Robert and they take off. They end up spending the night at the Swallows Inn in San Juan Capistrano. The Swallows Inn is still there, but it's not in the same location. It's across the street now, and I think it's more of a bar lunch place at this point. But apparently, at that time, it was a motel. And luckily, for the sake of the case and for Elizabeth, the motel worker jotted down the license plate of Robert's car. So from the telegram being sent to Elizabeth, reporters and investigators were able to track down where the telegram came from. And from that, it moved on to who this guy was. And they got that information from the Swallows Inn employee who jotted down Red's license plate. So Jimmy Richardson and his boys, they end up going to Robert Manley's home, knocking on his door. He's not home. His wife Harriet, who's holding their little baby, answers the door. They tell her what's going on. She denies that he would have anything to do with such a crime and that he came home that night on January 9th. But on that current night, that he was out of town with his boss and he would be back later. So on January 19th, Robert Manley was arrested in Eagle Rock at the home of his boss. So based on what I found records-wise, here is the house that Red Manley was arrested at. This would have been his boss's house in Eagle Rock. So back to Red and Elizabeth on the 8th of January. On the 9th of January, Elizabeth asked Red to drive her to the Biltmore in Los Angeles. She was going to meet her sister, Virginia, there. Initially, she just wanted Red to drop her off, but he knows the area. He knows it's the bad part of town, so he said, let me just go with you. Takes her to the Biltmore, and he stays with her for a little while. She goes and freshens up. So in the meantime, Red is looking for Elizabeth's sister, Virginia, who Elizabeth described. He goes and asks some of the employees. He's looking around the lobby, and no one matches the description. Eventually, Red leaves her there. So Elizabeth was seen there in the lobby between the hours of 6:30 to 10 o'clock. They said she went to the Western Union desk at one point. She made a couple of calls at another point. Why she was there, I don't know. I mean, they asked her sister if she was supposed to meet her there, and she said no. So why the Biltmore? Was it just to get away from Red? Was it really to meet someone else? I mean, these are things we'll never know, but these are the important questions in my mind. So as most of us, if not all of us, who are interested in this case, has heard the story of a doorman opening the door of the Biltmore for Elizabeth, tipping his cap, and she walks away down Olive Street into the fog. Now, that may be true, but in the DA's files from the LAPD summary of the case, and I'm taking this directly from the LA Daily Mirror, shout out to them, but this is directly from them, and this is a statement. Again, this is a statement from the DA's files. Quote, she was observed alone by employees of the Biltmore until approximately 10 p.m. January 9th. Mr. Studholm of the Biltmore Hotel stated that he observed the girl get up from the lobby as if she had been signaled by someone on the outside and walk out of the Olive Street entrance. He last saw her walking south towards 6th Street on Olive on the west side of the street. Investigators were unable to determine whether she made a phone call while there or not, but witnesses state they observed her on several occasions go toward the telephone booth. Unquote. One of the theories that some have considered kind of far-fetched, but I think it's something you got to look at, is the theory of Leslie Dillon and the Astor Motel. An author by the name of Payo Eatwell, I apologize if I pronounced that wrong, wrote a book in 2017 titled
Black Dahlia, Red Rose.
And I got to tell you, it's a good read. It's a solid read. Whether or not the stuff in there is true, I don't know, but it's very compelling the way she puts it together. According to Eat Well, the criminal psychiatrist for the LAPD, a Dr. Paul DeRiver, set a trap for whoever the killer of Elizabeth was in a magazine called True Detective. He set the trap in an article he wrote, hoping to kind of weed out whoever did it. And before long, a letter arrived at Dr. DeRiver's office coming from someone by the name of Jack Sand. And essentially, Jack Sand claims in the letter that he knows who killed the Black Dahlia, and it is a friend of his by the name of Jeff Connors. So as correspondence continued between Dr. DeRiver and this Jack Sand, we come to find out the real identity of Jack Sand is Leslie Dillon. So as it turned out, the doctor and gangster squad, Detective J.J. O'Mara, finally got together with this Leslie Dillon and tried to get more information out of him. Apparently, he knew the two details that the cops were keeping close to the vest in regards to what was done with the tattoo and what was done with the pubic hair. While interviewing Leslie Dillon, he suggested that the murder was done in a bathtub to drain the blood. So Leslie Dillon and Mark Hansen, according to Eatwell's book, were somehow seen and spotted at the Astor Motel, as well as a woman matching the description of Elizabeth Short. Also, the book talks about how the owners of the Astor Motel walked into cabin 3 and saw that there was a lot of blood and fecal matter spread out. As to why they didn't report to police, in my mind, I don't know. According to the owner, he did not want to deal with the police at that time. But to me, when you walk into a cabin filled with blood and fecal matter, it's something that I would call police for, you know. This theory, though, is wildly contested by Black Dahlia researchers, including Larry Harnish. Larry Harnish unequivocally states that Leslie Dillon was no doubt about it in San Francisco the night of the murder. So none of these things in the book really matter. But for me, I just say take a look at it if you're into the case. See if you like the theory. See if it grabs you. But nonetheless, it was a good read. And you might enjoy it. Now here is the motel in question, the Astor Motel that still stands today. I want to thank Rafa Palomo for going out there and getting this footage of the motel, of cabin 3, and the parking lot and everything else. For those that believe the Leslie Dillon theory, this is pretty interesting to take a look at. LAPD's chief forensic specialist, Ray Pinker, and his boys did come and test the rooms here, including cabin 3 at the Astor Motel back then. And the only blood that was found, if I remember correctly, was droplets from when a woman was menstruating. But as far as any trace evidence or any detection of any other blood at the time, it was negative. Now let's talk about Mark Hansen. He was the co-owner of the Florentine Gardens, which still stands there today. Mark had a house nearby to the Florentine Gardens on the back street there on Carlos Avenue, 6024 Carlos Avenue. And it was there that quite a number of the Florentine Garden dancers and entertainers, females mostly, would stay and room there, including Elizabeth Short. And based on another roommate there by the name of Ann Toth, who became a close friend of Elizabeth's, Mark Hansen took a liking to Elizabeth Short. Now, according to him, she didn't mean much to him. According to him, he kicked her out a couple of times. But it has been noted and it has been stated that he had a thing for her. He did take her in a couple of times to stay at his house, but he also did kick her out. Now, he claims the last time he saw her was December 8th. Mark Hansen stated that at one point he had to kick out Elizabeth and her friend Marjorie because Marjorie was drunk a lot, and Elizabeth would bring a lot of undesirables to the house. Strange men, according to Mark Hansen, and it just wasn't right, so he had to get them out of there. We do know, at least it's been noted, that in October, Elizabeth stayed at Hansen's house, October of 1946. So clearly, to me, it shows they had some type of relationship. But there was something there that allowed Mark to allow Elizabeth to stay at the house. According to Ann Toth, she stated that Elizabeth told her that Mark is trying to make her, and that Elizabeth told her she would sometimes have to leave her boyfriends or whoever she had with her at the time outside or down the street so Mark didn't see them. Mark did become somewhat of a suspect and was involved in the grand jury investigation, but they couldn't prove anything. Now, probably one of the more popular theories comes from retired LAPD detective Steve Hodell. Steve Hodell claims that his father, George Hodell, is the murderer of Elizabeth Short. And it's quite an extensive investigation that Steve has done, and a lot of work has been put into it. So I commend him for that. When George died, Steve started going through his belongings, sifting through stuff. And what sparked this investigation or this theory was that Steve found two photos of a woman who he thinks is Elizabeth Short. And from there, it just snowballed into a deeper investigation of his father. So Steven eventually filed what's called a Freedom of Information Act. And this gave him access to the FBI files on the murder of Elizabeth Short. Steve also found a folder containing receipts that dated back to when his father had contract work done at the house. And these receipts showed that the concrete bought for the contracting work was the same brand and size as the empty concrete sack found at the dump site on Norton Avenue. Now this house here, known as the John Sowden House at 5121 Franklin Avenue, is Steve Hodell's childhood home. And this house here is a popular fixture when it comes to the Black Dahlia case because of its link to George Hodell. They also call this house the Jaws House because of the Jaws-like fixtures above the door there. According to Steve, a hemicorporectomy, I think I'm saying that correctly, was the type of cut used on Elizabeth. And that type of procedure is where you can slice a body in half without breaking any bones. And apparently it was taught sometime in the 1930s when his father was in medical school. Another red flag for Steve was that George's handwriting was very similar to the handwriting in the letter sent to the police. It's also claimed by Steve that her uterus was removed, which I haven't seen in any other reports. Not saying it's not true, but I just haven't seen it. So based on all of that information that Steve presented, you know, it's kind of compelling, just depending on what you believe happened. I mean, there's some stuff in there you definitely got to think about. Probably my favorite theory would be the one by Larry Harnish. Larry Harnish is a former LA Times copy editor and writer. To me, this would make the most plausible sense. He explains it in really good detail on Feast of Death, which is a documentary on James Ellroy and his life and the unsolved murder of James Ellroy's mother, Geneva, which is another podcast that I did, Ghost of LA edition. You might want to check that one out. It's still unsolved, and it happened June 22nd, 1958. It's not as popular, nowhere near as popular as this case. But those two murders are pretty similar. At any rate, on Feast of Death, which is a very well-done project, Larry Harnish is sitting amongst LA detectives and with Nick Nolte and with James Ellroy, and they're eating and talking about cases and stuff. And Larry Harnish is getting kind of ribbed by the detectives because they're kicking around some of his theories. They're asking questions that he doesn't really factor in his theory. Now, during Larry's investigation of Elizabeth Short's murder, people were sending him things, and he tells a story where a box came in. He opens it up, and inside of it was a marriage certificate for Virginia Short. Now, Virginia was Elizabeth's older sister. Virginia was getting married to a guy by the name of Adrian West. So, towards the bottom of this marriage certificate, is a name, Barbara Lindgren, and an address, 3959 Norton,
which is one block from where they found Elizabeth.
So we dug a lot deeper and found that the woman who owned the house, or who at least was paying taxes on the house, was a woman by the name of Ruth Bailey. Ruth Bailey was the mother of Barbara Lindgren. Ruth Bailey was married to one Walter Bailey. Walter Bailey was a surgeon, former chief of staff at LA County, and an associate professor of surgery at USC. So now you have a very, very solid connection between Elizabeth Short and Barbara Lindgren. That would be Virginia Short. And that's more than a coincidence, in my opinion. And I encourage you to watch Feast of Death. Larry really lays it down, the levels of the research into this case, the levels of what he found out. Here's a Google Earth shot showing you the distance from Walter Bailey's house to where Elizabeth was found, and it was roughly 1,366 feet away. Pretty close. We'll call it one block. There's a series of pictures, popular pictures, that shows Elizabeth in much happier times. She's posing for these photos at John Marshall High School, in the front of John Marshall High School, at 3939 Tracy Street in Los Angeles. It is said that these photos were taken October 23rd or October 24th of 1946, when Elizabeth was 22 years old. Obviously, I cannot prove that. It looks about right. She looks to be in her early 20s. And it is one of the sites that myself and our co-producer, Rafa, went and visited to get more of a sense of the footsteps that Elizabeth walked. And here we are in front of the school, trying to get as close as we can to where she actually stood and sat. More or less, the high school looks the same. I'm sure it's had a lot of renovation. Matter of fact, we tried to get these same photos probably 6 to 8 months before we got these, and there was heavy construction going on. Everything was fenced off. But nonetheless, here we are at John Marshall High School, the famous location of not only a lot of movies and celebrities and things are associated with the school, but Elizabeth Short taking these photos there is definitely high on that list. Now here we are at the former location of the Washington Hotel at 53 Linden Avenue in Long Beach. Thanks to Jose for going out and grabbing this footage up for me last minute. This building here is where Elizabeth Short lived with Gordon Fickling in late July to early August of 46. Just about a half a block up at 102 Linden Avenue was Landers Drugstore. It was owned by a man named Arnold Landers, and I've heard so many different stories on where the Black Dahlia moniker derived from. I didn't really want to get into that, but I found it interesting that there's a documented quote by Arnold Landers, who owned Landers Drugstore, in regards to the name the Black Dahlia. Quote, "She'd come into our drugstore frequently. She'd usually wear a two-piece beach costume, which left her midriff bare. Or she'd wear the black lacy things. Her hair was jet black, and she liked to wear it high. She was popular with the men who came in here, and they got to calling her the Black Dahlia." End quote. The movie The Blue Dahlia had just come out in April of 1946, so maybe that was just a popular thing at the time, and that extended to Elizabeth being called the Black Dahlia because of her liking to black clothing and her jet black hair. Just a guess. Well, I want to thank you for joining me on this particular episode. It was one that I was looking forward to getting to, especially with the 75-year anniversary approaching. One of the most fascinating cases, and the fact that it's unsolved just adds another layer to that. I don't think it has the potential to fizzle away. It seems to be getting stronger every year, you know, with all these theories and reports. And especially the crime scene photos and the morgue photos, they are disturbing, but I think if you truly want to get enveloped in this case, you need to see those photos. But again, thank you for the time, and we'll see you on the next one.